At the beginning of 1940, which was one of the worst years in the history of this country, the late King George, King George VI quoted this in his broadcast to the nation, this well-known saying. I said to the man at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may head safely into the unknown. And he replied, go into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be better than a light and safer than a known way. Now there are many people who would concur with that advice, but would be vaguely unsure of just what its implications were. They would feel that even so there was some sort of risk that they were taking. So many people have only a very hazy understanding of God. They don't know him. They may know very little about him, but think that it might be a good idea to trust him in uncertain situations. But the question is, what do they know of this one whom they are called to trust? To be precise, what do they know about God? Just a few hours before he was crucified, the Lord Jesus Christ, in that great high priestly prayer, said these words, this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. Sorry, I quoted it in the authorized. That's what comes naturally to those of this generation. To know God is the greatest privilege that any man or woman can have. But be careful. Let's distinguish between knowing about God and knowing God, because there's a tremendous difference. There's a lot of people who know about God but don't know God. For example, I know a lot about the Duke of Edinburgh. I can tell you a lot about his history, about how he served in the Royal Navy, how he was the nephew of Lord Louis Mountbatten, and how he married Princess Elizabeth and became her consort and has been her consort for many years. But I don't know the Duke of Edinburgh. I've never met him. Excuse me. Never likely to meet him. I've never spoken to him. So knowing about the Duke of Edinburgh and knowing the Duke of Edinburgh were two completely different things. And so it is when we talk about knowing God. Knowing God, let's beware that we don't confuse knowing him with knowing about him. So today I want to ask the question, how well do I know God? This question is very important. How we think about God will affect our personal life. We may not think about him at all, in which case he doesn't affect our personal life. We may think a little about him, in which case it doesn't really affect our personal life very much. How well do we know God? In his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, W.E. Tozer says this in the preface. The Church has surrendered her once lofty concept of God and has substituted it for one so ignoble as to be utterly unworthy of thinking, worshipping men. With the loss of the sense of majesty has come the further loss of religious awe and of the sense of the divine presence. We have lost our spirit of worship and our ability to meet God in adoring silence. I'd like to use a rather obscure verse in Daniel as a basis for our meditation. How well do I know God? And I quote it in the New King James. If I quoted it in the NIV, it wouldn't really make much sense because it's only a partial in the paragraph. But what it says is this: people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits for God. So we see that knowing God is not just a passive thing. It's an active thing. It is not a mere intellectual acknowledgement of certain facts and propositions. Knowing God will result in positive action. Daniel was a man who knew his God, and that knowledge fully governed his life for 70 years and more. And we read in the book of, as we read in the book of Daniel. I firmly believe that Christians today, we need to refocus on God, and so that we will know him in an increasing measure. And as we learn to know him more and more, eternal issues will become more real, and God will become more real to us. Other things become less important. I don't mean by that we just we're so heavenly minded that we're no earthly use. But what I'm saying is that knowledge of God will greatly affect us in how we live. Now, as I say, I'd very briefly like to illustrate from the life of Daniel how knowing God can produce an effective Christian life. No doubt it will be in different ways for different people, but nonetheless, it will be no less effective for each one of us. Firstly, those who know God have great thoughts of God. C.S. Lewis published a book quite a number of years ago entitled Your God is Too Small. In this book, he showed many misconceptions that people have of God, and these subsequently find their way into the church. For example, there are many today who think of God as a doting parent, ready to overlook any misdemeanors. And on the other hand, we find those who find God as a hard, resident policeman, ready to pounce and condemn any peccadillos. There are some who say, well, I did trust God at one time, but he let me down and I can't be bothered with him anymore. Such thoughts show a clear misunderstanding of an almighty, holy, wise, but merciful God. As the young preacher Charles Spurgeon said this, he who often thinks of God will have a larger mind than the man who simply plods around in a narrow globe. The most excellent thing for expanding the soul is the science of Christ and him crucified. And the knowledge of the Godhead, of the glorious Trinity, nothing will enlarge the intellect, nothing will magnify the whole soul of man as a devout, earnest investigation of the subject of the deity. Now think in Daniel. As a teenager, he was taken from Jerusalem, taken from its temple worship and all the religious institutions, and he was thrust into Babylon, that great city, the greatest in the world at the time. City that was full of temples and idols, a complete anathema to any religious Jew. Daniel did not bemoan his fate, but actively participated in the political life of Babylon. And for 70 years and more, he remained absolutely faithful to God. The key to the whole book of Daniel, which Daniel himself reiterated to all the kings that he served, the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. The Lord is king, even in Babylon. God knows and foreknows all things. There is nothing in the universe unknown to him, not even the smallest detail. Neither is there anything beyond his control. He will have the last word, not only in world history, but in the destiny of each and every one of us. His kingdom and his righteousness will finally triumph, for nothing, neither men nor angels, nor archangels, nor the devil, will thwart him. God is king. Think of the prayer of the early church in Acts 4:25. They had much to pray about, but they didn't start off praying about the things that were bothering them. What they did was beginning their prayer with an acknowledgement of God and creation, an awareness of the spiritual warfare on earth, and how God had worked in the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. Is this our view of God, which our prayers express? Does the sense of God's holy majesty, his moral perfection, his infinite power and gracious faithfulness keep us humble day by day, dependent upon him and obedient to him, as it did for Daniel? How well do we know God? How great are our thoughts of him? People who know their God will have great thoughts of God. Secondly, people who know their God will have great enthusiasm for him. If we read that section of Daniel 11 where we found our text, we find the people of God in a situation where they are almost overwhelmed by evil. Like many of the Old Testament prophecies, the passage has a fulfillment historically, which in this case was in the 2nd century BC. But I believe that Jesus' prophecy, referring to this section in the book of Daniel, Matthew 24:15, which says, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand." And this came around in AD 70 when Jerusalem was destroyed, razed to the ground by the Roman general Titus. Now, laying aside any prophetic interpretation, I just want to read a few verses, and you'll find, if you like to find them, you'll read them in Daniel 11, and it is from verse 27, it's rather a complex passage, but what it says, verse 21, it says, "The king of the south, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress, and he will abolish the daily sacrifice." We're talking about the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Then they will set up an abomination that causes desolation. With flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But, and here's the verse, the people who know their God will firmly resist him. People who know their God will firmly resist him. Or, as the New King James has it, will do great exploits. Now, what actually happened here was a powerful military man had set himself against God and the people of God. This Syrian king by the name of Antioch Epiphanes, he invaded the land of the Jews. He prohibited the worship of Jehovah. He banned the Jews from practicing every aspect of their religion. He set up an image of Zeus in the holy place, and to crown everything, he sacrificed a pig on the altar of sacrifice. Now, in spite of this, there was a few faithful Jewish remnant who stood against this king. Why? Why did they do this? Because they had great enthusiasm for God. And in this, they preserved Jewish worship, which lasted until AD 70. Daniel himself had the same enthusiasm for God. When Darius, the Persian, suspended the practice of prayer for a month, Daniel refused to comply. He continued his custom of praying three times a day with his windows open, and he prayed towards Jerusalem so that all could see him. Why did he do this? Because he was an awkward man? No, it wasn't. It was because he had great enthusiasm for God. We have all these different circumstances. Enthusiasm for God can manifest itself in different ways. If we look at Daniel again, the example of his prayer in Daniel 9, we find what was his concern for the ruin of Jerusalem. Not because the city was ruined and he wanted it rebuilt just to restore Jewish national pride. No, to Daniel, the ruin of Jerusalem was a slur on God's glory. He recognized it was the sin of Israel and its leaders that had provoked this judgment of God. Jerusalem lay in ruins. Daniel's prayer was for the restoration of the city. I suggest that a reading of Daniel 9 from time to time could greatly improve our prayer lives, both as individuals and as a church. Do we know God? How great is our enthusiasm for him? Think of the Apostle Paul in Corinthians 11. He logs his sufferings, all his floggings, his hunger, his thirst, his shipwreck. Why? Because of his enthusiasm for God and for the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. You see, people who really know their God have great enthusiasm for him. Can I suggest that perhaps our enthusiasm for God could well be an indicator of our knowledge of him? Thirdly, those who know their God have great contentment in him. There is no peace like the peace of God. In our reading in Psalm 46, we find the psalmist at peace in a turbulent, changing world. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. Notice, that he does not say, we will not fear that the earth gave way. But he says, we will not fear though the earth give way. The psalmist was a realist. And he did not look on God to keep him from trouble, but to preserve him in it. A brief study of this psalm indicates the possibility of massive environmental catastrophes and international warfare. But in all this, the psalmist has the reassurance, be still and know that I am God. And he can confidently respond, the Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. In AD 410, when the barbarian hordes were at the gates of Rome, a 60-year-old Christian bishop took up his pen, and in the hour of darkness and despair, he wrote a book which has become one of the great classics of Christian literature. Augustine called his book Concerning the City of God, and this in effect said to its readers, you thought that the passing of Rome and its empire, the stability it gave to the world, was an end of the Church of God. You are utterly wrong. Rome is an earthly city and not indestructible. The Church of God is everlasting, and unlike Rome, cannot be destroyed. Earthly cities will rise and fall. The city of God remains. Augustine had great contentment in God. If we think too, again going back to the book of Daniel chapter 3, his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, they stood before Nebuchadnezzar, called in because they refused to bow to the Nebuchadnezzar's image. If you do not worship the golden image, says Nebuchadnezzar, you'll be thrown in to the blazing furnace, and what God will rescue you from my hand? The reply of these three men is classic. We do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter, they said. No panic. Simply an unshakable trust. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to deliver us from your hand, O King. A polite but unanswerable statement. But if not, if no deliverance comes, we will not worship the image you have set up. It did not matter to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego whether they lived or died. They had great contentment in God. Perhaps one of the greatest examples of contentment in God was the Apostle Paul. In Philippians, we read this, I have learned to be content, whatever my circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned to be content in each and every situation. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. Contentment in God. Can I suggest again that the comprehensiveness of our contentment is a measure of how much we know God. A great aunt of mine lived in the Highlands, just outside of Oban. She lived in a little cottage, two rooms, no electricity, no running water, no gas, nothing. She cooked over a fire. My mother said, you could write over that cottage, godliness with contentment is great gain. And old auntie I didn't know her. She died when I was about 6 or 7. She was one of the most godly women that I've heard of. Now, the comprehensiveness of our contentment is a measure of how much we know God. But the fourth and last point, do I know God at all? In our deliberations, we are thinking about people who know their God. Now, in the world today, there are very many people who do not know God. What then? We have already referred to the Lord Jesus Christ in his great high priestly prayer just before he went to Gethsemane. Now this is life eternal, that they might know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. Here is a challenge. What is your attitude to Jesus Christ, the Son of God? Contrary to political correctness, there is no other way to God except through him. A truth which is emphasized throughout the New Testament, but often ignored in today's liberal Christian ethos. To come to know Christ, it is essential to acknowledge him and your complete unworthiness of his love towards you, to confess your sin and to call upon him for salvation. He has promised, he who comes to me, I will never turn away. Until you come to know Christ, you will never know God. So, in conclusion, can I suggest 4 ways in which we can measure our knowledge of God? Firstly, what conception do we have of his greatness? Secondly, how great is our enthusiasm for him? Thirdly, how great is our contentment in him? And fourthly, do I really know him at all? The people who know their God will stand firm and take action.